When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Trade season is starting a little bit earlier this year, so we got some prospect shuffling to talk about. Luis Arraez and the nice little package going over to Miami. We're going to break that down. Also, Christian Scott's big league debut. Got to talk about that. Kyle Manzardo called up, and man, this is the best version of Kyle Manzardo we have seen. So excited to talk about where he's at as he gets his chance to debut for the Cleveland Guardians. And then Mason Black, he made his big league debut, looked really good out of the gate, and then welcome to the big leagues, the second or third time through the lineup, and that's what comes with the territory. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. But Jack, it feels really good to already be able to break down some prospect returns. I feel like that's some of the most enjoyable things that, you know, we get to do. Is just, it gives you an opportunity to just talk about all different prospects at different levels and assess a package. And that's what we get to do with the Marlins being sellers in record time on the first week of May.
I think there are levels to this. I think there are levels to baseball fandom. Number one is really enjoying watching baseball be played. And like, those are my favorite types of people. Those are my favorite people to interact with at restaurants, bars, parties, wherever it may be. And then you run into people like you and I who really love trade season and the off season, where we can play the hypothetical game and we can plug and play. Oh, how would Dylan Head look as a Beloit Skycarp? Let's see. I'm very curious to see how this shakes out. Oh, Usuk Go is going to Pensacola. Or no, he's going to Jacksonville. Jacksonville. That's awesome. Let's talk about that. Like, I don't like us, but I like that we can talk about it, which is a good thing.
No, and you know, the bridge of that is I had a blast watching Marcy in the Arizona Fall League, one of the better places to watch baseball. But I agree, like, that's the absurd thing, and I think is why this show works for us, is that, I mean, there's nothing more fun than putting together these prospect packages, trying to conceptualize, you know, what these returns could look like for a player. And, you know, I think we had discussed a little bit of it in the past, maybe just off air or whatever. Oh, what would a Rise package look like? You know, what could a package for this player look like? When you know that teams are sellers, you start to go down that path. And, you know, I already want to start to put together some mock trades, but I'm going to hold off a little bit longer than that, which we always do on justbaseball.com. But like, I'm totally with you. I think that's one of the most fun parts. And that's why that trade simulator that I can't stand was fortunately put behind a paywall. But there's a reason why it exists, is people love to just play GM. And I think in this instance, you have two really interesting GMs that are, I think, in different ways fascinating to just monitor and evaluate. You have a Peter Bendix who, you know, he's a president of baseball operations, but it's just fascinating. I guess they both are here with Preller and Bendix, but it's fascinating to kind of see how is he going to approach this and how is he going to change the way that things are done in Miami. And we talked about this on a really deep level on the Just Baseball show. So for those who want, you know, our whole thoughts on what this means for the Marlins franchise and just my perspective and Jack's perspective on that, check out the Just Baseball show where we talk about that. But we're here more to talk about the return in itself. But I was just kind of interested in just seeing what Bendix's first big trade looks like, because it kind of shows you what his approach is going to be to the prospects that he wants to add to the system and you know, what kinds of players he's generally looking for. And then when you look at the Preller side, it's just always fun to see what Preller's going to do. It's just pure entertainment. But I also think that there's certain things that like in these moves with Preller that I think can tell you a little bit about maybe what they feel. And it might be a little bit too much speculation, but you know, when I look at the return, which we'll walk you through it right now, it's headliner is Dylan Head, first round pick in 2023 by the Padres, and a guy that's a top 100 prospect for us, 88th overall on our top 100 list. You also have Jacob Marcy, who was the Arizona Fall League MVP, really had a nice season last year. We've talked about him a lot on the show as a guy that I really liked after getting those live looks. And then Nathan Martorella, who has had a phenomenal start to the season, has put up great offensive numbers at each stop and looks like another one of those middle round finds by the Padres. And then, as you mentioned, Usuk Go, who I think was more of a salary dump in this situation, but it's still a decently intriguing arm reliever that will go straight to AAA. And the Marlins will probably try to get him up to the big league sooner rather than later, because they're not going to want to pay a guy more than $1 million to not pitch at the big league level. But when you look at what Preller did here, I think, you know, Marcy and Martorella were guys that I think he always knew he was probably going to move at some point this year, especially with Merrill settling in and you know, the preference of Paulie, even with the inconsistencies. I think they feel like Paulie is just a higher ceiling and better player overall. We'll see how that works out, but it just seems like they feel like he's a better fit there. I think to me, it tells me a little bit about Dylan Head potentially just being further off than they thought. And that's not saying that Head's not as good. I think it's just saying he's not going to be a guy that absolutely rapidly flies through the minor leagues. I think once they identify guys that are a little bit more of a project, they can be expendable. Even a James Wood, right? Like, I think they knew that James Wood was going to take some time. So, hey, that's a guy that I'm a little bit more comfortable moving. I feel like the guys that Preller doesn't move are the guys that he can fast track. And if there's somebody that he feels like may take a bit more time, maybe he's a bit more willing to move them. And that's my takeaway with Head, because Head has some of the ingredients to be a guy that could have flown quicker than a lot of high school bats. But I think we're seeing in the early going here, he's got some maturing to do, and that's normal. He looks really talented a lot. You know, nothing has changed in my evaluation, but he's been a little bit aggressive. There's been a little bit more swing and miss, and he's going to take some time, as most high school freak athletes do. And AJ Preller doesn't have time. He never does.
I think one of the AJ Preller is one of the very few people that answers questions for us before the question even arises for us. And, you know, something that I know you really like to do is kind of project who can be that rapid riser through the system. Ethan Salas, we never thought he would be the rapid riser through the system, because we were more and more surprised with each promotion that he got. We were surprised when he got to Elsinore. We were really surprised when he got to Fort Wayne. And then we were flabbergasted when he got to San Antonio. So Preller beats baseball media, prospect media, to the punch when it comes to promotions. And when he can't do that with a guy because he doesn't think they can handle it, then I guess we have to just assume that that's a red flag for him and he's ready to depart. I like the point that you brought up with Wood, because try putting James Wood in the Jackson Merrill spot. He would flounder, I'm sure. The acclimation process would be nowhere near as smooth as Jackson Merrill. And, you know, like Salas, he wasn't ready, but he tried. Preller's going to try with everybody that he thinks could maybe sort of kind of somewhat handle it. I think we see Robbie Snelling in the big leagues this year. Like, it's that kind of thing. You've got prized possessions that he's willing to push to their absolute limits. We saw Abrams stink when he got up with San Diego. We even saw a guy like Tucapita Marcano get up and stink in the big leagues. How about Ryan Weathers? Got up, stank.
And he was like, good, and then he stunk.
Yeah, and he was good in the postseason. And then Mackenzie Gore, like, they were ready to shove up after he started 19, or was it 18 in Fort Wayne? And 19 was Elsinore, which was high A at the time, and then it was double A. I mean, they were ready to shove that guy into their plans in 2020. He was hanging out at the alt site. So everybody in the last half decade, 7 years maybe even, that Preller has felt could handle a lofty, lofty promotion, he's given it to them before they're ready.
Yeah.
And for him not to do that with Wood and Head makes sense now that they're not Padres organization members anymore.
Yeah, and honestly, for their sake, it might be better that way. I mean, look at where James Wood's at now. And I don't know if he has this progression, if he's thrown into the fire. And you know, I think you kind of knew, AJ Preller did, that, hey, this is not a guy that I want to throw into the fire. He could be a superstar. He could be an MVP candidate. But he's not somebody that you want to rush the progression on. And I think we're seeing now what we saw in spring training at the end of last year with the adversity that he faced in Double A, staying there and working through that, then making some adjustments in the offseason and looking like a much more complete hitter. James Wood has had the nice, you know, steady progression that I think has allowed him to look like a guy that could get up to the big leagues this year. I'm sure we'll have some adjustments and things, but we'll be as prepared as possible. Whereas I think in other situations, you know, if he stayed in San Diego, who knows how it would have went. I think with Dylan Head, again, I don't even think anybody in the Padres organization's evaluation has changed. But I think if you're AJ Preller and you see that, hey, he's not going to get there as quickly, you're more willing to part with him. And the Marlins, you know, they paid a lot of money for the Marlins to kick in, you know, almost all of Luis Arraez's salary for this season.
They paid him down to the minimum. They wanted
Dylan Head. Like that, yeah. That was the big thing here. Yes, I think Marcy is a great get. And I think Marcy and Martorella, this is not a report or not anything like that, but my assumption would be Marcy and Martorella are probably included no matter what. And I think there's probably some other third piece. And I feel like for the Marlins to be able to get Dylan Head, I think the only way that the Padres were going to be okay with that was if the Marlins took on Luis Arraez's contract because of how tight the financials are for San Diego. But this really also, I think, highlights how tough the financial situation is for the Padres. When the Marlins are kind of throwing you a bone financially, that shows you where they're at payroll-wise. But I also think that it was a unique opportunity for the Marlins that we talked about the Mets and being able to get a Drew Gilbert, get a Ryan Clifford, get a Luis Angel Acuña, get all these different prospects that, you know, are big pieces in their farm by adding money. And that was way more than what the Marlins added here. But I don't think the Marlins get Dylan Head without adding that salary for this year and covering that. And I think this is a huge get for the Marlins, even if Head is several years away, because he instantly becomes their best position player prospect. He instantly becomes a guy that you can start to look at that 2027, you know, Marlins chart, lineup, yeah, and put him in center field and be excited about it.
And I mean, the leadoff
still have to happen, but you can do that and feel good and be excited. They haven't had guys like that. Even a Victor Mesa Jr., you're like, I hope, you know, you can't confidently just put a guy there and dream. And so I think that is really exciting. But then you also balance that with a Jacob Marcy, who's a high floor big leaguer, at the very least is a fourth outfielder who will be a good role player for you. You need those guys with where the Marlins are at organizationally. And then a Martorella, who I don't think is as high of a floor, but still a really good chance of being a big leaguer in some capacity, but both have the upside of regulars as well. Like that's something that this organization really needed. And I think, you know, you look at what Peter Bendix did here, I thought he did pretty well in a vacuum, considering that Luis Arraez has a year and three quarters of control, and there's not a lot of teams banging down the Marlins' door to go get him. And I think the fact that the Marlins did the deal right now tells you how good they feel about the return.
Yeah. So on Friday night, when this went down, my initial reaction from the Marlins' perspective was, oof, like, this sucks that they're moving on from Arraez. I woke up on Saturday saying, you know what, like, this is a solid return. I think it's pretty good. Like the word that you just used, pretty good. And as we talk on Tuesday, I think Peter Bendix did really well here. Like the more it kind of sits with me, the more I think that this was going to be the best offer that he got for Luis Arraez. And I like that he jumped on that. And we talked about that a little bit on the Just Baseball show. I think that these are two really smart executives. These are two really smart guys that are putting together different puzzles. They're trying to find the pieces to the puzzle, but Preller's filling out the big league puzzle. Preller is trying to find the most cost-effective way to put together a World Series caliber team. And he got better by doing that. He found a good puzzle piece for that. What Peter Bendix is doing is he's trying to figure out a way to make one of the worst farm systems in baseball more well-rounded and overall better. And he found some great puzzle pieces to do that. I remember in spring training, you were talking about Marcy as a guy that could plug and play as a fourth outfield hybrid if Merrill didn't work out in spring training. So here we are talking about that guy along with a top 100 prospect in baseball, along with a guy that was mashing at the high A and double A level, along with a guy that was signed out of the KBO when he was a shutdown reliever over there for the last 3 years.
Yep.
I thought this was a really good return given the situation for the Marlins.
And just a little bit more on Marcy, because I love how you mentioned a guy that I definitely thought could be, you know, in that role for the Padres if you know, it didn't work out for some of their other primary options. And Marcy's off to a bit of a slow start, but if you look at a lot of the underlying batted ball data, like one of the bigger WOBA to ex-WOBA discrepancies that you have right now in the minor leagues, but also just what he did last year between the Arizona Fall League and his minor league season. It was 151 games. He had a 904 OPS. He had 21 home runs. He walked nearly as much as he struck out. 294, 429, 474 slash. And also, I think, what was it, 46 bags, 45 bags, something like that.
Yeah,
he's 45. A good defender in center field. And he's, you know, what I love about him is he's only an above average runner, but he's a phenomenal defender in terms of just being able to maximize, you know, that average or above average speed. His instincts are great. And you see the same thing on the base paths, just a really good base runner as well. The power is fringy, but he elevates consistently, only a ground ball rate of about 35% last year, and extremely patient. He's run chase rates around 15, 16%. So I do think that there's an everyday player in here because of the ability to play all three outfield spots, because of the ability to outslug the EVs, because he doesn't chase and he's able to walk and having a left-handed bat there. I think all the little things that he can do, he can piece that together enough to be, you know, a 2-3 win player if it all works out. And that's a really nice piece for the Marlins to add, not even 23 years old yet. And again, I know he's off to a bit of a slow start this year, but he is hitting the ball harder. And I think that's something worth noting and monitoring as well, because if that power ticks up a little bit, then you have a really good chance at an everyday player here as well. So I think Marcy was a good get for the Fish and you know, also immediately becomes one of their better outfield prospects as well. I mean, I think if you look at this system right now, and it's a testament to just how bad the system is, I think it's Dylan. And we haven't done Marlins prospect rankings yet, and I'm going to wait because there's no reason for me to do them now when you know that they're going to trade more guys and continue to.
There is a reason. There is a reason to do it now. Griffin Conine still has prospect eligibility.
Yeah. But now he's going to get passed up now as they're replenishing the farm. We won't be able to justify the name to watch anymore. But no, I mean, when you look at the system here, like this will be a little bit of a teaser, I guess, of what the rankings are going to look like. But again, there's going to be a bunch of new names coming in. Dylan Head's the top position player prospect for me. I think you go Mesa Jr. as the number two guy, but I think Marcy is right there with Mesa Jr. I don't think he's far off at all. So that kind of puts it in perspective. You got 2A, 2B there. And then Martorella, I'm sorry, like he's the third best position player prospect in the system. He's better than Jacob Berry. He's better than Giddy, or fourth, yeah. Excuse me. He's the fourth best. So, I mean, they acquired the three of the four best position player prospects in their system. I mean, what else can you really want out of a return? And then whatever they get out of Usyk, go. He's better than Berry in terms of, you know, Martorella is better than Berry. He's better than Alderman. He's better than any of those other position players that they have. So, you know, I think that's more of an indictment on the Marlins system, but it still shows you like you needed these pieces badly. And I think it helps them a lot. A bit more on Martorella.
Yeah.
There's going to be a lot of pressure on that bat for sure. And that's the tough part. And I think that's why it seemed like the Padres is willing to part with him there. Mm-hmm. But who cares? Because yeah, I think again for the Marlins, it's like they just need guys that can hit. It doesn't even matter where he plays. They need a sub 25-year-old prospect that can hit. Martorella's 23. He's off to a really nice start. The slug hasn't totally been there yet this year, but last year we saw him put up some impressive EVs. He had a 90th percentile of 105 and a half. I mean, that would have been one of the better figures in the Marlins org. Another patient hitter, sub 20 chase rate, and makes enough contact. I think there's enough here to be an everyday player. He wasn't elevating a ton last year. This year, he's elevating more. And I think he's trying to find that balance, like the Manzardo conversation we're going to get to. I think with Martorella, it's been a little bit of that, where now he's trying to hit the ball in the air more because he knows that he's got a slug. And now the EVs have taken a bit of a hit, but he is elevating more. So trying to find that middle ground, and I think he will. And if he can completely find that middle ground, there can be an everyday player here as well, or at least a, you know, strong side of the platoon type of guy that you can hope for.
So can we play a quick game before we move on to the Manzardo, Scott, Mason Black conversation? Mm-hmm. I'm going to throw you a Miami Marlin, and you tell me if the return just like, and I'm not asking you to sit here for 10 minutes and make a T-chart and think about it. I'm asking you just gut reaction. is the return better or worse than what they got for Luis Arraez?
And is this assuming that they eat the salary or no?
This is, well, it's tough because a lot of these guys are very early in arbitration, so it's not going to hit as hard as Arraez. Because like Arraez is making $8 million and they paid it down to the minimum. Like they pretty much paid $7 million for this. Yep. This, it's like, are you going to pay 1.5 to bump Jazz Chisholm down to the minimum? Like probably not. And like even then, you know, chances are the Padres aren't making the move. So it's kind of like it might be a non-factor in the deal. But let's start with Jazz. Jazz Chisholm has one more year of control than Arraez does. Arraez is up after the 2025 season. Jazz is up after the 26 season. Does Jazz net them a better or worse return than Luis Arraez?
Slightly worse.
Okay.
I think slightly worse.
Okay. How about Trevor Rogers?
Much worse, but I still think it really really depends how he throws. The last outing was brutal. I still think a decent return because he's a lefty with what, 2 years of control after this one or one?
Yeah, 2 years of control.
Two. Yeah.
So let's play this game. Guesstimate what the return could look like. So Arraez, in essence, was top 100 prospect and then two guys in the top 15. So you got three top 15 prospects for Luis Arraez. Jazz Chisholm, what does it look like?
I think borderline top 100 guy and then one top 15 guy and then a filler.
Okay. Yeah. So like 10 to 15 range and then like 1 to 5 range. So two top 15 guys and one of them is a top flight guy. How about Jesus Luzardo?
That bigger. Yeah. I think that's the biggest package.
Yeah. Assuming full health when he comes back.
Yeah. And he looked really great in his rehab start. And it kills me, man, because that's the one area where you'll see like the South Florida like fandom in me come out a little bit because I see a hometown kid that was going to the ball games just like I was, that grew up a Marlins fan. He's living out his dream, you know, playing for the team, and then you know now he's going to be their best trade chip. So he knows it. He has to know it. Like it just it's the business of it. It sucks, but growing up a Marlins fan, like you're really living the dream. You truly got to be a Marlin. You got to play for them and then get traded. Like you're really living the dream of all the players that you love to watch. So, but I think even with what it's one more year or for Luzardo, it's
two more years.
It was a mild flexor strain. He's going to be back. He already looked good in his rehab start. If he makes a few good starts and looks healthy, I think that return is even more than Arraez on whether or not they cover the money.
On par with Cease or worse?
Slightly less than Cease, I think, because of the durability aspect. I think the durability aspect has just become so, so big now. Like, yeah, I think that's why Cease was just such a no-brainer. Like, it, you know, I think if Cease had, let's say, the same injury history as, you know, Luzardo, the return would be way less because of the volatility of his performance. So, you know, I think you're looking at is who can minimize as many variables as possible. Yeah, I still think that Lizardo's getting you a haul. Like more, I think two top 100 guys.
Two top 100 guys, and I think a guy in the 11 to 15 range.
I agree.
Okay. Last one that I want to throw you is one of Braxton Garrett or Edward Cabrera, who both have all four arbitration years left. They're both Super 2 candidates. So they've got 4 years of control after this. They're not up until the end of the 2028 season. Which one do you move and what does that return look like?
Which one do you move is tough because I would argue both. But I mean, realistically, I think Braxton Garrett because I prefer Braxton. Like if I'm building a franchise, it depends what pieces I already have. I feel really good with Braxton because I just know every fifth day, great chance at a quality start. Guy threw 160 innings last year at a 3.66. And then, you know, before that, it was 88 innings at a 3.58. Stuff's not great, but clearly he just knows how to pitch and just continues to do that. With a guy like Edward, you have the injury concerns, you have the command issues, you have all those variables. But you also, I think if you're a GM taking over a team or a president of baseball operations taking over a team, there's a scenario where you look back and you say, oh, my goodness, I can't believe I gave up Edward Cabrera. I don't know if there's ever an instance where you look back and say, oh, my goodness, I can't believe we gave up Braxton Garrett. Like you might look back and say, oh, we could use him right now if they become competitive in 2 to 3 years. But there'll never be an instance where it's like, oh my gosh, how did we trade that guy? He's the next best thing. Edward, you know, if it all clicks, we know what it can look like. And we've seen a couple starts where it's been there. I'm not the biggest Edward guy. So like I personally would lean towards moving Edward. But I think Braxton at this point commands more of a return with less of the injury history. I know he's dealing with like a little bit of a shoulder thing, but it's mostly just dead arm and fatigue. I think Braxton brings in a mega haul with what he's been doing and with the years of control too. I think people would be surprised at what he could get them.
I would say three top 15 guys, two of which in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
And if they really burn it down, then you start streaming the minor league games on Bally Sports South or Bally Sports Sun, whatever it is. I don't know what the Marlins are on right now.
I think it's South just Bally Sports Florida.
Bally Sports Florida, yeah, because Bally Sports Sun is Tampa. There's way too many Bally Sports. But, that's when you start streaming the minor league games on there. And that's when we talk about the Miami Marlins as a top 10 system in baseball. Like, if you really burn it down, and there's a chance Bendix does this year, I mean, we're talking about the Marlins as a borderline bright future now.
And they have to. They have to. Like, there's no way, and I think the people are like that are talking about it, like, oh, they just made the playoffs. Like, why didn't he invest in the team? There was no way you were reversing the luck that team had last year. Or not reversing, but there's no way you were duplicating it and reversing the regression that was imminent with any talent that you were going to be able to add in free agency this year. Also, just knowing that the budget is so limited. But then you also just look at the talent or lack thereof from top to bottom. You have multiple guys that are going to be free agents. You still have, I think, one of the worst positional situations organizationally at shortstop and catcher. Like, I don't think there's an organization in baseball that is worse off at shortstop, catcher, and before this trade in center field. Like, yeah, straight up the middle, three of the most important spots. If you go like full depth chart organizationally and combine those three positions, I don't think there's any team in baseball, any organization in baseball that had less talent up the middle, center field, shortstop, and catcher than the Miami Marlins. So how do you build a franchise? Like, how do you build a sustainable winner when you have nothing at the three key positions? And you can even say, oh, but the pitching's good. If they didn't draft, I mean, they have Noblemeyer and Thomas Waite. That's great. And those guys are far off. They're still battling command issues in low A. Meyer was great. We'll talk about him actually in a little bit. But I mean, other than that, then who are your other pitching prospects? Dax Fulton's on the shelf again. And then who else you got? Carson Milbrandt?
So I mean, like, Meyer, like, do you even consider Meyer a prospect anymore is the thing?
Like, sure. But, you know, again, is that a building block? I think it's just another piece. It's another piece. So, you know, they definitely are. I think people were really underestimating how thin that entire organizational talent is. So, yeah, I would burn it down. I really would. And then you could still field together a rotation that'll get you through and go from there. But it is it is tough times for Marlins fans. I get it. But I do think that from a sustainable winning perspective, this was the first of the moves that I think will eventually put them in a good spot. And don't forget, Tanner Scott should get them a nice return. A lot of teams out there need some relief help. Fnardi kicks it back into gear. They've got other relievers that they could send out to.
Yeah. Do you entertain moving Jesus Sanchez or no?
I mean, if anybody's willing to, I would absolutely.
Yeah. I feel like there would be some sort of value there, like not immense by any stretch, but
you could probably attach him. You know, what if you attached him to a reliever? Maybe that can get you a bit more of a return.
Nardi and Sanchez could get them something equivalent to Tanner Scott, I do think.
I don't disagree with that at all, because if you put Jesus in the right spots, I think he can succeed a little bit more. But remember, Bendix was part of the front office that sent Jesus out, you know, when he was a Ray. I think they saw some of the red flags there. So I don't think he'd have any issue sending him out of town again.
Yeah. There are two untouchables on this roster. We talked about it on the Just Baseball show. Like, they both have a brace on their arm right now. It's Sandy. Yeah. It's Yuri Perez. Those are the untouchables. Everybody else, thank you for your service.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Unfortunately. But fortunately, I think ultimately, I think, again, it'll be the best for them in the long term. We're going to talk about Christian Scott's debut. It was a lot of fun to watch, and he's almost ready to start his next outing again very soon. We'll get to that in a moment, but before that, a quick break.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So Mets prospect Christian Scott has probably been one of the most frequently brought up names on the show of the last couple months because we've been pumped up on it. And we felt like he could get up to the big leagues and make an impact right away. And that's exactly what he did in his first outing. And I mean, you couldn't have really asked for much more from Christian Scott in Tampa, not too far from, you know, where he grew up, several hour drive. I know he had family there and everything. 6 2/3, 5 hits, 1 earned run, 1 walk, 6 Ks, 94 pitches, 67 strikes. I know the Rays offense hasn't been the best in the world right now, but that was not why Christian Scott did what he did. Right. Christian Scott did what he did because he filled up the zone, he hit his spots, and he had that slider working. And I want to talk to him so badly because I want to talk to him about the changeup. Because that pitch was so devastating for him last year and just hasn't been there for him nearly as much this year. And it just hasn't really mattered. The two different sliders is just, it's a nightmare for hitters. And I'm noticing this trend now through the Mets system. Watch Tidwell's start the other day. And by the way, we put out that minor league recap this week. It's every Monday evening. Go check that out. Really pumped about the second edition of that too. That's linked in the episode description, but kind of this week in minor league baseball once again. And we made some subtle tweaks. It's a little bit shorter. And let me know what you guys think in the comments. I would love to get any feedback. We're going to keep churning those out. But I recapped Scott Starr and Tidwell. And I'm noticing that there's a trend through this Mets system, which is the bigger sweeper and then a harder, cutterish slider. And I think the philosophy is that while these are similar pitches, they're different enough to where if you don't have a true curveball, you don't have to only throw a slider. You can throw two variations of a slider that are different enough that it is almost the same thing as having two completely separate pitches. And we're seeing that with Scott and with Tidwell, who went 8 shutty the other day. But with Scott, it was the same thing. Bigger sweeper, freezing hitters a lot with that. And then the harder, shorter slider, they can get whiffs and work against lefties as well. And then that fastball, man, like he's got all the confidence in the world in that. And that's what you always love to see from a rookie making his debut, knowing that he can go to the Express and blow it by you and have that confidence.
So Jared Jones went 7 one-hit innings. I think it was 7 one-hit innings. Shutout ball, punched out 10. He had 17 whiffs on Saturday. Christian Scott had 18 whiffs. So Scott had one more swing and miss than Jared Jones had in one of his best outings of the year, if not his best outing of the year to this point. So that tells you what Scott was doing in Tampa. And again, climate controlled, like there was no shadows to deal with. This is in a dome, in their place, and he came in and sliced and diced them. I like the point that you make about the cutter slider combo. There are more and more guys, notable or not. I see it all the time from AAA pitchers. If you don't turn the ball over and you are a slider guy, you're a breaking ball guy, I see so many people that are fastball, cutter, slider. Why? Same feel, different shape. And we talked to Paul Skeens about it. And Skeens, I think, actually summed it up as well as anybody that we've heard sum it up. It's the same grip for him. Like we've talked about the different iterations of his slider and how, you know, it can kind of turn into a sweeper. Sometimes it backs up on him and like actually kind of dives a little bit arm side. But like, man, I mean, it's the same thing. He's just feeling something different. Like he's turning the ball a little bit more. Same grip, turning his hand a teensy bit more. I bet it's different grips for Scott, but it's the same idea at release with Christian Scott. And if you have the same idea and you can get different results, do you know how simple that can make pitching for you if both are on? Like, it's such a complex thing. You're playing a chess match. Simplify what you can And Scott now has two pitches that could feel like one or one and a half. And that is simplifying something that doesn't need to be complex.
Yep. And so far this year, combining those two pitches, he's landed him for a strike at a 69% clip.
Again, so, because he's got the feel for one, he probably has at least a decent feel for the other.
And think about this, too. You mentioned like just a similar, you know, feel. If you're a low three quarters guy, which Scott is, and that's part of the deception that he's able to create and get that perceived ride, it's really hard to turn over a curveball from there.
You can't.
You can't. So for him to have, most guys from that angle are going to be limited to one breaking ball, which is going to be a slider. So being able to maximize that into two, because it's two different, you know, slider types that are different enough, I think is huge here. And then, you know, we'll see as that changeup continues to come back. He threw some decent ones in that start, and it's been coming back for him, you know, over the last few starts. If that's there, then good luck, because that fastball has just been playing for him really well also. And I think he picked up plenty of whiffs that route also. I'm excited to watch this guy every fifth day, because I think it's clear that the Mets are better with him on the bump, and he seems to be here to stay. I'm wondering how they're going to manage his innings, things like that. But you know, he's nowhere near that spot yet. And I mean, they clearly let him run here, going 6 2/3. So I think he's a guy that's going to be able to eat innings for them as long as he keeps the ball in the yard. And that's pretty much the only thing to monitor, is just not hanging those breaking balls and not having those fastballs run back over the middle as much, because he can just be around the zone too much just because of how much he likes to throw strikes.
It's hard for me to see a world where he starts hanging things left and right because of the way his arm path works, because of how long he is. Like, it's almost like his body will not allow him to hang pitches. And the only way that happens is if, like, he's really trying to baby that thing into the zone. And he doesn't strike me as a guy that's going to baby anything.
No. And he turns the page really well, too. We'll give up a homer, makes the next pitch. And he's got that mentality as well, which is huge. Yeah. Mason Black made his big league debut, and the beginning was great. I mean, he struck out Bryce Harper. You're striking out guys left and right. And then, you know, the welcome to the big league moment kind of happened, and he finished against the Phillies on the road in Citizens Bank. Tough place to make your debut. 4 1/3, 8 hits, 5 earned runs, 3 walks, 4 Ks. I feel like you got to come away from this if you're Mason Black and feel like you still belong. I mean, seeing how uncomfortable you had big league hitters, seeing when you execute your pitches, what you can do. I mean, there was a sequence to Real Muto where it's, you know, change up, slider that was just disgusting for a called strike, doubles up on it, foul ball, and then strikes him out on a fastball that just gets on him quick. Similar with Bryce Harper, where he goes like slider, sinker, and then a changeup to freeze him. So like, there's ways that he's able to kind of mix and match, sequence pitch backwards and get outs, and then just try to get a lot of weak contact. I do wonder if ultimately the role for Black is like that piggyback Ryan Walker type, but I think he's going to get a few starts. We'll see how it goes. And I think he can still settle into a back end of the rotation role, especially at home. Given that, you know, it's just such a tough place to hit the ball out. He's a guy that does like to pitch to contact and has done a good job of getting weak contact. Yep. Yes, he's been getting swing and miss in AAA. I don't know if he's going to get as much at the big league level. And there's going to be more pressure on the ability to keep the ball in the yard, get weak contact, and not give away those free passes. I think that's another big part of it. But, you know, I didn't see a guy that doesn't belong. To me, I saw a guy that could be a back end of the rotation starter and definitely can be a plug-in guy. But I also think the floor is clearly, at the very least, a swingman type with the funk and with the stuff that he has. And I wouldn't be surprised if he bounces back and has a better next start.
Yeah, so I'm totally with you that he should feel like he belongs. And I think this start is the perfect poster boy start that proves that people need to like watch the games and not just line score assess. Like, if you assess the line score, it's like, oh, rough debut for him. I'm totally with you. Watching this start back, he belongs. Absolutely. And I love that you mentioned he had like a Bryce Harper looking very uncomfortable. He had some of the best hitters on the planet right now looking very uncomfortable. And that's so important. And you know, we talk about that with guys on rehab too. And I mean, I know you and I were both up late last night watching Walker Buehler, and Buehler, the line score doesn't look Buehler-esque, but he should feel good about what he just did. First time throwing in 2 years. And at the end of the day, like, I mean, he dominated some of those, you know, lower level hitters in that Marlins lineup. So you should feel good about Mason Black coming away from this one. And baseball's a long game. It's a long season. He's going to throw a lot of times this year, whether it be in Sacramento or San Francisco. It might take until three or four, outing number three or four in the big leagues, for you to really see what this guy can do. But if he is sporadically showing that he can make guys uncomfortable and then put it together and start four, the conversation around Mason Black changes.
100%. And I think, you know, when you look at it from this lens too, it's he was cruising until the third time through the lineup. And at the very worst, if that's something that doesn't totally change, okay, Mason Black's a guy that we don't really want to see the third time through the lineup. All right, that's fine. Like, that's still a great big league role and an arm for you that's going to be valuable. And that's again, something that could totally change. Is, yeah, if you look at the third time through, he had a lot of two-strike counts. He just couldn't quite put them away. And that's what happens when you already put them away. Once, maybe twice. And now the third time through, they kind of know what you got. And it's much harder to put the Bryce Harpers of the world away. He ambushed the first pitch, but there were some other guy, Real Muto and Schwarber. It's harder to put those guys away. So, you know, I think that's the thing to monitor. And even if that's something that doesn't totally come along in his rookie campaign, he's still of use to the Giants as a guy that can turn the lineup over once or potentially twice and be valuable. And they are creative with the way that they use their pitchers. So they're not just looking for guys who can go six innings every fifth day. They're looking for guys who can get big league outs in the roles that they deploy them in. And they're going to try to figure out what role is best for them. A couple more regular starts for Black. We'll see if that third time through the lineup thing is a trend, or if it was just kind of him maybe slowing down a little bit and just some of the best hitters in the game, as you mentioned, adjusting. And we'll go from there. But again, I think this is a big league arm one way or another.
For sure.
Any other debuts to talk about?
Manzardo.
Yeah. We'll talk Manzardo. And then to wrap, we'll just do a couple quick just performances that stood out to me over the week. We'll just kind of fly through them. Manzardo getting the call for Cleveland is awesome. The circumstances are unfortunate. Stephen Kwan, who's just been so awesome, unfortunately going down, stinks. And, you know, hopefully he gets back quick. But Manzardo is a guy that deserved to be there yesterday. And I'm glad he's getting a crack because he had nothing left to prove. And just legitimately had nothing left to prove. He's done it at every stop. And now at Triple A, we're seeing the final form and the best form of Kyle Manzardo. Also talked about this in the YouTube breakdown, but you know, we've seen that the exit velocities tick up each year. We've always known that Kyle Manzardo is a plus hitter pretty much since his first year in pro ball, where he took, you know, professional baseball by storm.
Yeah.
But we saw the approach continue to get better. Now he's running a chase rate in the low 20s, and the approach has always been there too, but just continuing to get better. And we've seen the power tick up and up and up. It was a 90th percentile of like under 103 miles an hour in 2022. Then it was just under 104 miles an hour last year. And now it's right at almost 106 miles an hour this year. So you're seeing the power tick up and up and up. You're seeing him elevate more and more and more. And you're not seeing those contact rates compromised at all. What else do you want to see? That's the final form of a guy that I think can be a masher at the highest level. I don't think anybody really knew that there would be this much raw power in there, because the EVs just weren't there for a guy that you're not dreaming on much more projection physically. He was already 22, now 23, going to be 24 years old, but he's clearly added some strength. He's clearly found some ways to tap into more power, and he's elevating while still matching his contact rates. If anything, they've been as good as ever. That is a really fun recipe. I saw the Guardians might be planning to play him in the outfield some. That's kind of crazy. But you know what? He's there to hit. So that's the most important thing. But I saw – so former classmate of mine – well, he was several years ahead of me, but Hayden Grove does great stuff for Cleveland.com. And I saw his tweet that said Vogt had said that he's planning to DH first base and outfielder. And I was like – Whoa. Hey. Okay. Sure. As long as he's up there hitting, that's all I care about. And I know his first game was not great. It was a hat trick. Welcome to the show.
So I want to kind of contextualize that hat trick in a moment, but finish your thought.
I was just going to say, like, I know it wasn't great. He's got a hit. Look, if it keeps him in the lineup, that's all I care about. So, I mean, it's just interesting to have him in the outfield, I think.
Do you know the last time he played the outfield?
Hell no.
It wasn't college.
I don't think he's ever played the outfield.
There's nothing in the baseball reference database that says he's played the outfield past high school. Maybe high school. Maybe. Maybe summer travel ball. I don't know if there was like a spring training game where he hopped in the outfield at all. Like, because big league spring training doesn't populate.
Only other position I see is third base in
when?
Some summer collegiate league.
With the Portland whatever in the West Coast?
No, third base for the Wilmar Stingers.
I don't even have that. I've got him playing with the Portland Pickles in 2019, and he played 31 games at first base, and that was it.
Yeah, so, I mean, let me go double-check. But Hayden Grove is – my guy's on it. I mean, Pinecrest, we churn out – they churn out journalists over here, all right?
You're a really good journalist. Hayden's not missing that report. So while
you
look that up, I want to kind of contextualize the three punch-outs because I think this is important. Jack Flaherty looks as good as he has since he put together that amazing year. I think that was, what, 2019 when he finished, like, top five in Cy Young voting, and he looked like a beast. He looked like one of the next best pitchers in baseball. Flaherty buzzed him with 96 up and in, perfect on the corner, and he swung underneath it. There's nothing that many pro hitters can do with that. Then the next one, perfectly executed slider, low and inside, to get him to swing and miss. And then Joey Wentz, lefty-lefty matchup. Wentz is a lanky lefty that comes from a long three-quarter slot, ripped a cutter that started knee-high, bent below the zone. It was three perfectly executed pitches against him, two from Jack Flaherty, who is on a tear right now, and one from Joey Wentz. And lefty-lefty, cutter, perfectly executed. I really can't fault him for any of these. None of those strike threes were like, oh, he looks overmatched. No, they were just perfect pitches.
I mean, Flaherty's on another level right now. I know our guy Clay Snowden is putting together a piece. He texted me earlier today and was just like, hey, you know, have you seen anything like super different with Flaherty? He's getting 2 more inches of vert on the fastball. The fastball's up a tick. So that already helps a ton between those two things. The curveball has always had great depth, and now he's throwing it 2 ticks harder. And there's so much research that shows, you know, the difference between a curveball with the same amount of break at 76 versus 78, the whiff numbers jump. And then his slider's a tick and a half harder too. Same thing, where you'll see the whiff numbers jump when it gets to that certain point. So he is definitely closer to that Jack Flaherty that we've seen in the past. And I mean, that's a really tough matchup for Manzardo. I'm not too worried about it. I agree. I'm not worried about it at all, actually, I should say. I agree. And I hope he just continues to get opportunity out there. I'd imagine that the outfield conversation meant like he's going to get work in the outfield during, like, you know, live BP, you know, or during BP getting live reads. And depending on how he looks, that could be something that they decide to do down the line. I remember they used to roll Josh Naylor out there, and they're not going to do that ever again. So maybe just in a pinch when they really need an offensively driven lineup, like left-handed heavy, they could do that. I think that's more of just a, hey, we're going to try it kind of thing. I would be surprised if they threw him out there, just you know, throwing him to the wolves like that. That'd be pretty absurd.
Right.
But regardless, he's there to hit, and I think he's going to do that. So hopefully they play him consistently, even if he does start a bit slowly. Also, just saw a report when I was going to look on Twitter. Jack Leiter's in Oakland. So looks like he's going to potentially make a start. I think if they give him another big league start, he's going to look really good. I do genuinely believe that. He bounced back with 6 one-hit innings, first start back in AAA, and then had another decent one last time out. It would be nice for him to get another opportunity sooner rather than later.
Also, did you see the Mason Miller quote on Foul Territory?
No.
Mason Miller was with our friends at Foul Territory, and they asked him, if he doesn't like why he doesn't have a cool visual like closer entrance, like a light show and all that. And he said something along the lines of, if they turn the lights off, I'm worried they might not come back on. Tough, but appreciate that coming from Oakland A's players. I'm always going to say Oakland.
That's so good. Just to wrap, a couple just headlines, you know, around the minor leagues. We got the Complex League fired up here, and that's always fun. I think it's as fun as ever. I don't know if I'm just like dialed in on a different level this year or if the Complex is more talented than ever. I think it's more the latter, where we've just got so much prospect intrigue at the Complex. You got guys like Felnin Celestin making their pro debut, which is unique because he didn't even get to make his DSL debut last year due to a grade two hammy strain. Celestin already has 4 hits in 2 games. You got our King Ramon Ramirez, mm-hmm. you know, playing, making a stateside debut at the Complex for the Royals. He's been awesome out of the gate. Several doubles and a home run already. Jeter Martinez with the Mariners, who we're going to talk about later this week. I'm really excited to talk about him because there's a big uptick in the fastball. He's been touching the upper 90s. That's a guy that is super talented. There's just some arms I'm pumped about from recent drafts too, like Cole Schoenwetter, who we were talking about with the Reds, had a really nice debut at the Complex as well, punched out 6. And then, you know, you've got other guys like Rainer Arias. I think there's just so many intriguing prospects right now at the Complex that I think it's a fun time to be dialed in. And I think it's an area where we can kind of clue people into how much talent is down there. Before we started recording, we were talking about Hyun-Suk Jang of the Dodgers. And I'm hearing he was up to 98 in his Complex start. I mean, this talent is just crazy, man. We got guys at the Complex that are freaks. So I'm excited about that too.
Baseball's as good as it's ever been, man. Hyun-Suk Jang is a guy that I'm very excited about. And I told you, cause I was just like reading what I could read about him. He's a big man. And the video that I saw of him just kind of throwing like live BP sessions, I'm just like, you are big. I really enjoy watching you throw. And if he's up to 98, 99, I know when he was like 95, 96, he was, you know, at about like 2,500, 2,600 on that 4-seam fastball. I mean, dude, if he's 98, 99 at 2,550, 2,600, like, look out, man. We could have another, like, Hyun-Suk Shim on our hands in the Pirates organization who, like, he's thrown very few professional pitches, but
every single one was like, whoa.
everyone is drunk on the Kool-Aid on Hyun-Suk Shim, and I think Hyun-Suk Jang could kind of fall into that, too.
Amazing how you're able to just nail the pronunciations back to back like that.
It's all, you know what it is? Like, you see it once and then you know how to do it. You know what I mean? You know what was really tough was this entire week saying Damiano Parmigiani in like real time.
Damiano, like, yeah, I can't do it. No, you're actually right.
Ground ball to the right side. Damiano
Parmigiani. Yeah, right. In real time is tough.
Like ground ball to the right side, Parmigiani's got it. Like,
yeah, that's hard.
Holy smokes.
There's something about the L and the M and then back into the soft G. Yeah, that is tough.
That's
you know, the second you flub it, people are like, oh my God, this guy stinks.
This guy's a moron. How does he not know how to say Damiano Parmigiani so quickly?
Like, it's so easy only word I'm thinking about at that moment.
Caveman could do it.
Paul Wilson, also, we just talked about him in the Tiger system, had yet to see his pro debut, 4 scoreless at the Complex. I texted you. I'm like, dude, I'm going to start just pulling up to Complex games. I never thought I'd do that. There's just too many fun names out there. A couple other just quick like housekeeping notes. Noble Meyer had his best start as a pro.
Cool.
And we broke that down in the YouTube video. So I just wanted to plug that, check that out. Stuff was insane. That was fun to watch. Who else? There's a couple other guys that really stood out. Oh, Nazir, we got to figure out if it's Mule or Moulet. There's an accent over the E, so I think I'm going to go Moulet. Return from TJ. He'd been throwing an extended spring, Cubs prospect. Two-way guy when he was drafted. I think, you know, he's going to focus on the mound here. But up to 97, 98, averaged about 97 in his return in a game, you know, Complex setting. Went 2 innings, struck out 5. That's a great sign. They gave him $1 million to forego his college commitment. And I know that's a guy that they're excited about from, you know, a talent perspective. and to see him up to the upper 90s in that first start, I mean, that's pretty exciting. So I think they've got some, again, the Cubs, man, you just got to keep looking at what they're doing and some of these guys that they're identifying. And anytime they overslot somebody, you got to pay attention. And it looks like they have a talented arm there in Moulet.
I just checked. Nazir Moulet. We got Moulet. It. Moulet. Put some flavor on it. Moulet.
Hell yeah. Ralphie Velasquez homered twice?
Yeah. I mean, I'm locked in on the Lynchburg Hillcats right now. Clemmie's not off to a good start at all. Alex Clemmie is really struggling, but Tugboat and Ralphie on the same roster? Come on now.
Yeah, so I have, it's full disclosure, I have zero connections to Tugboat. But I just fired. I never really do this for guests. Like, I usually just go through. It's either somebody I know or somebody I know knows them or whatever it may be. I just shot Tugboat a DM straight up. I haven't heard back yet.
That's okay.
That would be one of my favorite interviews that we could get. That's one of the few times I've ever just shot a DM and said, hey, dude, hey, like, we have a show. You want to come on it? But like, I need. Do you know we threw in the Little League World Series?
Yeah.
Like, I need this guy on the show, man.
I need it.
I need him on the show. Lázaro Montes, by the way, mm-hmm. probably could have made the YouTube video cut. We didn't mention him in there. His last eight games, Jack, 432, 500, 919 with five homers. What I'm most impressed by is you've got three hit game, 0 for 4, two hit game, 3 hit game, 3 hit game. We know we can hit homers, but to see the multi-hit games, I mean, that's nice to see.
Baby Yordan is so unfair, and I really hate that comp has been thrown out. And he trains with Yordan's guys, right? Is that,
yeah, that's what
is that happens, how that works? Yeah. So, like, I know that has been a comp that is circulating, but there are very few guys that are as big and as powerful as Lázaro Montes in minor league baseball that have the feel to hit that he has. And
I've seen that develop, honestly, in months. It just seems like it's getting better and better from a field to hit perspective.
I think this guy is just scraping the surface of who he can be as a hitter. And the fact that he's 19 years old in low A doing this right now is utterly insane. I mean, I strong armed you into making him a top 100 guy, and I'm going to stand by him until he's done, until he gets non-tendered. I am going to be standing by this guy because, I mean, he is so big, so strong, and so smooth. And I feel like those guys are foolproof.
I agree when you're seeing, like, what he's settling into now, too. He moved his hands up a little bit more and a little bit further back. So he's even closer to where he wants to be from his slot. You look at guys like Yordan, like the big guys, Ohtani. They don't want to move. They don't need to move.
No.
Get to your spot. You're so freaking strong. If you can stay back, you know, most guys need a negative move to keep them back. But if you're able to hold your, and he controls his weight well, if you're able to hold your weight back without a negative move, why add movement? Just get there and stay there. And so he's brought his hands up and a little bit further back. And I think it's just allowed him to simplify things and just let his freak ability eat. And the other side is, I'm seeing more B swings from him now, which I love. The other day he had, a change up down and away, throws the hands at it, flares it out to center field for a base hit. Like, you know, he's going to crush the home runs. So to see that in his bag too, that could be a massive difference maker for Montes, who, by the way, now, you know, he's going to strike out. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. Like, as he gets to better competition, he's going to strike out. But so far this year now, 16 walks, 17 strikeouts through 118 plate appearances. That's impressive at any level, especially for a 19-year-old who's 6'4".
So once we get into the hands firing in the swing is when you lose me, and really, like, when I need you to just mansplain me, like, what's going on with the swing. But setup, I'm getting a better feel for. And Montes, I've totally seen it where, like, he's almost here. And you look at it at the side, like, he's kind of pushed off his back shoulder. Right. And he's here. He's extended. And all of a sudden he can just shoot straight down.
He's already got the tension.
Yes. Note what happens with Yordan, too. Yordan, he's got his bat hanging out like on his back. Like, if you were to look at the side view, it's not hanging out like this. It's hanging out like this.
He's in his slot.
He's in his slot. And it's simply like turning and letting the big dog eat. Ohtani, same thing. He starts out, but then he pulls back and you see that like emphasized pullback. Yep. And those guys, man, I mean, like, it's so much fun seeing a big man swing in a simple way. Yep. And it seems like Laz is a big guy that's swinging in a simple way.
And I love the angle now, too, where it, I think it just allows him to get right into the slot. And like that, that's all they really need is just a slight little pull backwards from where they're already at and go from there. Because for big guys, it's just so much more ground to cover. It's for a big guy to get his bat all the way back and into a slot from like a relaxed standpoint. It's just a lot more to repeat. And it's a lot more limbs to control. So seeing Montas kind of make those subtle adjustments while he's already succeeding too is what I love. And I think, you know, that's where the Yordan coach and, you know, them being in the Mariners org, like that's where that stuff matters, because you have a receptive player who's willing to continue to improve and continues to look like he's just progressing every single time you check in. Ralphie Velasquez probably doesn't even need to make any changes. That swing is just crazy. It's been so fun to watch him do what he's doing. And then, you know, I think we'll probably do a little bit more of like a recap later in the week of just other performers and things like that. But it's been fun to see some of these young guys at the lower levels really mash and do some good things. One last name I just wanted to highlight real quick, just because I'm always rooting for him and we've talked about him briefly, is Gunnar Hoglund. Came out and had another good start again. And now in the A's organization, Double A, you know, he's had a litany of arm issues, 7 shutty, 8 Ks, 1 walk, 2 hits. He's still sitting in just the low 90s, but the stuff looks pretty good. And it's just nice to see a healthy Gunnar Hoglund out there and throwing well.
100%.
That'll do it for this episode. We will be talking Mariners prospects with you next time out. It's going to be fun to break down that very talented system, including Laz Montas. So looking forward to that. Check out that YouTube video we put out. Bonus episodes of The Call-Up in the episode description. As always, thank you for listening. We'll talk prospects with you later this week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.